Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program when the diagnosis is cancer of unknown primary, guidelines for care. Now, this is a very important program that we're offering today. I have to say this is the first time that we've offered a telephone education workshop on this topic in the 20 years we've been doing these telephone workshops, and we hope it will not be the last, and we'll be offering this again. It's a very important topic, and we have wonderful speakers on the program today. Now, today's program was actually made possible, really, it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 537 participants. And you come from all of the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from American Samoa, Canada, Syria, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world. So it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers have prepared. There also is information about all other cancer organizations that are wonderful resources for you for free help and support. And there is an evaluation form. And we really would appreciate your completing that evaluation form. Since this is the first time we've offered this particular topic, we very much want to hear what you think of the program today and also your recommendations for other topics and other programs that you would like us to offer. So we very much rely on your feedback. When you think about it, who but each of you can tell us best what we should be doing. And so please just take a moment and give us your recommendations, and we will try very hard to implement them. Also, today's program was made possible by Friends of Cancer Care and an educational grant from Biotheranostics, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. So we have wonderful speakers today. We've assembled really, I would say, the world's experts on this topic, and I want to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Gauri Varachari. And Dr. Varachari is Associate Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And she's going to start by giving an overview of CUP, or Cancer of Unknown Primary. She's going to discuss diagnosis and a clinical evaluation and the multidisciplinary approach to treatment. Dr. Varachari.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hello, everybody. I would like to start with the definition of CUP. CUP is cancers of unknown primary, and I will be referring it as CUP. Now, this is not a rare entity. It is one of the 10 most common cancers worldwide and represents about 3 to 5% of all cancers. We believe it's about 60 to 70,000 patients in the United States every year. And to put it in perspective, pancreatic cancer is about 32,000 patients every year. So it's almost double of pancreatic cancer in terms of incidence. Now, a definition of CUP is presence of metastases, that is, spread, without an identified primary cancer site. This means that the cancer has spread to a site distant from where it has originated, and the tests show the spread but do not show where the cancer has originated. And therefore, for most patients, it is stage 4 at presentation. So to reiterate, for a cancer to be called as CUP, it needs a biopsy-proven cancer diagnosis where the anatomic site of original cancer remains unidentified after a directed, though very intensive, and thorough search for the primary. A standard workup for a patient presenting with CUP cancer includes a thorough history and physical examination done by an oncologist. The physician has to consider patient's age, risk factors, other exposures that the patient may have encountered through work or hobbies. And an important aspect of the history is the patient's family history, information on past biopsies and past surgeries. So really a very thorough dialogue is important. The physical examination is needs to be thorough despite patients' lack of symptoms if they don't have any. And all patients need a rectal exam. Men need prostate and testicular exam. All women should get a breast exam. And I think a vaginal exam if they have any symptoms. Following a history and physical, diagnostic tests are very important. Patients get blood tests, CAT scans, and of course, most importantly, evaluation of the cancer tissue, which is biopsy of the most accessible site. Blood tests include blood counts, liver and kidney tests, and directed tumor markers. Now, these are proteins that are shed in the blood. They can be nonspecific. Most are aware of something called as a PSA, prostate-specific antigen, ordered in men to rule out prostate cancer, and there are other such antigens that are checked in the blood. They are not diagnostic for any particular cancer in the cup situation, but they can be helpful to follow response to therapy and give us clues as to where the cancer may be coming from. But let's first talk about biopsy of the most accessible cancer site. I cannot stress enough on the importance of getting adequate material, preferably from a core needle biopsy, not aspiration of a few cells, but getting a good chunk of tissue because it needs a lot of testing. So the first thing the pathologist does is to subject the tissue to light microscopic examination after staining it. And on light microscopy, the pathologist then calls the cancer either an adenocarcinoma or a squamous cell carcinoma or just an undifferentiated cancer if they really cannot give the details of what the cancer looks like under the microscope. Most patients, 60 to 65%, will have adenocarcinoma as the histologic diagnosis. About 5% will have pure squamous cell, and another 30% will have a less differentiated cancer or an undifferentiated cancer where a pathologist has a harder time detailing the histology. A small percentage of cancers are also called neuroendocrine cancers. After the light microscopy, the pathologist then proceeds to use additional stains on this biopsy tissue, which can help differentiate the cancers originating from various areas of the body. So there are stains for breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer. Again, these stains are helpful to a certain extent, and they guide us to make therapy decisions, but they are not necessarily always diagnostic. It is, again, important to have adequate tissue to do these tests, and a communication between clinicians and pathologists is essential because no stain is 100% specific. In 2009, we have even more sophisticated tests like gene expression profiling that can help sort out some of the possible primary origins, and Dr. Greco will discuss that in some detail. So while the tissue is undergoing additional testing, in parallel, usually the patients are also getting additional tests done. All patients get a chest X-ray, CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. Women need mammogram. Usually a mammogram within a year or two suffices. Sometimes you need an additional study if there's a high suspicion of breast cancer. With increasing availability of these sophisticated tests like PET scans and various endoscopies and capsule study, the team has to decide on to what extent of this workup is warranted for each patient, and to see how each additional test is going to impact the choice of therapy, the patient's life expectancy, and their quality of life. Now, we do not do PET scans on all our patients. I think PET scans are helpful in some groups of patients, those who have swollen lymph nodes in the neck and have a squamous cancer without a known primary, sometimes where surgery is being considered and you want to do a PET to determine the extent of cancer and make sure that there is no additional sites of cancer if the patient is going for surgery. And sometimes it's a good alternative to somebody to use instead of an MRI if somebody has allergy to iodine dye. Most importantly, after all these tests are done, the doctor has to determine the patient's performance status, that is their sense of well-being, how strong they are to take therapy, their nutrition status, their comorbid illnesses, and the cancer-induced complications, which will impact initial treatment planning. Now, before I go into the treatment planning part of my talk, I just want to digress and mention one point, because patients often ask, where is the primary tumor, and will we find it during the course of treatment? The genetic basis for tumors that present as CUP remain unclear. One hypothesis suggests that the primary tumor either regresses spontaneously after seeding the metastases or remains so small that it is clinically undetectable. An alternative hypothesis is that the primary tumor is kept under check, tiny but kept under check due to host immunity or some other chemicals that are secreted locally. But some cells escape and they are in an organ that has a rich soil for the seeds to grow. It's really hard to study these hypotheses because we do not have an animal model that can simulate this scenario and we do not understand the biology very well, but still with newer technologies, we are beginning to get some idea about what may constitute CUP cancers. I think about 2 to 4% of patients who have had a thorough workup may show a primary cancer over after months of their original diagnosis. I've certainly seen it, but it's not very common. Moving on to the last part of my talk, which is treatment approaches to CUP. The treatments have continued to evolve as we see new drugs approved for known cancers. Most often, patients need systemic chemotherapy, which is drugs given through the vein or orally. It goes all over the body. This is the primary modality treatment. There is integration of surgery, radiation therapy, or even periods of observation in management of our patients, and it depends on the sites of disease, their symptoms, as well as how well they can tolerate treatment. The oncologist uses clues from patients' clinical presentation from the pattern of their cancer spread, that is it in the lungs, bone, liver, lymph nodes, and the data from the pathology to make a treatment plan. Often patients get started on two drugs, and it's not uncommon for a platinum agent to be one of the drugs. More recently, there are newer chemotherapies used in other cancers that we are also using in CUP cancers. Some cancers that present as CUP have a higher chance of benefit from chemo, especially the cancers that behave like breast cancer or ovarian cancer or colon cancer. And patients who have fewer sites of disease or cancer in the lymph nodes have a better chances of response than patients who may have a disease that is in 3 or 4 sites. But the bottom line, it's not hard to make a treatment plan, even though no two CUP cancer patients are alike. Most importantly, each patient's therapy needs to be individualized based on the patient's symptom and ability to handle treatment. So in summary, CUP cancers are an entity of their own. Patients need to be reassured that physicians do have a treatment plan even if there is no primary cancer in place. The imaging and testing of tissues can span over 1 to 2 weeks. It takes more detective work to figure out a treatment. And with newer targeted therapies and newer tests that are now available, we are very hopeful to make significant strides in the treatment of CUP cancers as we create personalized therapies for our patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much for Dr. Varachari for an excellent really overview and just really outstanding presentation to give everyone a concept of a CUP and cancer of unknown primary. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Anthony Greco. And Dr. Greco is director of the Sarah Cannon Cancer Center. And Dr. Greco is going to talk about the important role of clinical trials, and he's also going to talk about emerging diagnostic technologies that are so important. Dr. Greco.
Oh, thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be with you all today. I thought maybe what I would do is talk about the emerging diagnostic technologies first and then a little more about the importance of clinical trials. As you've heard, it's very frustrating both for physicians and patients to not know where their cancer is coming from, and this is what CUP is in general. We've learned over the years that there are a number of patients, however, that fit into various subgroups and which are treated more successfully than the group as a whole. And this has been as a result of a long time reviewing patients and pathology and realizing certain groups are different than the group as a whole. And this is important to understand. And along these lines, we are learning more and more about the way various cancers look, and we have better technology now. You heard a little bit about tumor staining. These are various proteins that are in known cancers. And by direct comparison, we know that some of these stains, which are easy to do just from the biopsy specimens, can lead us down a certain line of reasoning that perhaps a CUP patient might have, for instance, a colorectal primary, even though one can't find this with colonoscopy because it's just too small to see, or perhaps it has actually disappeared after it's sent out metastasis or spread, or perhaps it's hiding in the colon and it's too small to see by colonoscopy. These stains can sometimes give us a clue, they're not perfect, that this could be colorectal cancer that we have found in the liver where it's spread. This is much more treatable, for instance, with specific therapies. So that would be a very important clue. And this technology is developing and very important. Probably even a more important technology is looking at the actual genetic makeup of the cancer itself. This whole area is exploding, particularly in the last 5 years. Techniques are available to look at the actual gene expression of normal tissues and of cancers. And there's a lot of information about what the genetic profile or the genetic expression looks like in known cancers. And therefore, it would make some logical sense to apply these same techniques, so-called molecular profile test, which can be done on biopsies of cancer tissue. There are several of these available. And apply this to patients who have this CUP cancer. And if the genetic expression of their cancer cells matches, for instance, lung cancer, that might be appropriate that they would receive treatment for lung cancer, the best known treatment we have for lung cancer. If, on the other hand, the molecular profile matches patients who have known colorectal cancer, it would make pretty good sense to consider using our best therapy for colorectal cancer, et cetera. Now, the tests are not perfect. They're not 100% accurate in identifying even known cancers, and we're not sure that the genetic profile or signature of unknown primary cancer or CUP cancer is the same as known cancer. So we have a lot of work yet to do. Plus, like some of the other stains, they're not totally accurate. There's overlapping patterns. So as a clinician, we need to use all the information, the patient's symptoms, the pattern of spread, the types of stains that have been done, and again, these are very important in our evaluation, as well as these molecular profiling techniques. Use all this information and then clinical judgment to try to come up with the best treatment for each individual patient. Now, clinical trials are not unique to CUP cancer. Clinical trials are important in all of medicine, not just oncology, because we often don't know exactly which treatment to use. Sometimes it's an opinion, it's judgment, it's based on a few patients. What we need is scientifically designed approaches so that we can feel very confident that the therapy recommended to our patients is in fact better than what was available before. So any new treatment or any treatment we think is better, unless it's extremely effective, we need to do a clinical trial and compare the therapies. One of the most important areas in CUP cancer now is to feel confident that these new molecular profiling techniques will in fact improve the outcome of patients by applying a site-directed therapy, for instance, based on these molecular profile assays, along with the clinical features and the tumor staining that I mentioned earlier. We need to show that in fact is a more reasonable and, more important, a more effective way of treating patients. And this will require clinical trials, require testing in a scientific fashion, in order to feel comfortable and confident that we are making progress. My own feeling is that this indeed will be an improvement for individual patients, but just because I feel that way doesn't mean it'll absolutely turn out to be that way. We've been using sort of approach to therapy, or one size fits all, for patients with cup cancer for many years. We've developed these, and they definitely help some patients. There's no question about it. But we, at the same time, we've been using therapy for other types of advanced cancers, such as breast and colorectal and lung, and we've learned which specific treatments work better, and they're different. So it would make all the sense in the world that the cup syndrome or the cup cancers need to be treated more specifically and based upon what they actually are behaving like. And this is where the problem comes in. What are they behaving like? Certainly treating patients with a regimen that's useful in lung cancer but does very little for patients with colorectal cancer would not be the best approach for that patient who had colorectal cancer. So we need to be able to make an intelligent judgment about what the cancer is likely to be, and then we have a better chance of helping each patient. As treatment improves for colorectal cancer, lung cancer, kidney cancer, liver cancer, and it is, it's improving remarkably in the last few years, then we need to apply those same cancers to patients with cup cancers. Feeling confident, however, that's the right direction to go in. And only through clinical trials are we going to be able to prove this definitively. I appreciate being able to talk with you all today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Greco. Excellent presentation, excellent really review of the importance of research and trials. And I want to thank you. I know there will be questions during the Q&A for you. And thank you. Our next speaker then is Dr. Keith Eaton. And Dr. Eaton is Assistant Professor at Thoracic Head and Neck Cancer Division of Oncology, University of Washington, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. He's Assistant Member of Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Eaton is going to really address the kind of issues of pain and symptom management, follow-up care plan, and communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Eaton?
Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today. So today I'm going to be talking about supportive care, and what I define as supportive care is that basically all the treatments that we deliver that aren't directly treating the cancer for the sake of treating the cancer, it's more aimed at symptom management. And I would argue that this is as important, if not more important, than the anti-cancer treatments that we give, because they're really directly aimed at the patient experience of illness. These symptoms can be cancer-related or can be related to treatment at times. And today what I'm going to talk about is issues that are of concern to many patients with cancer in general. They don't apply to every patient, but they're common enough that I think they deserve mention. So pain is a symptom that many patients with cancer fear. Certainly not all patients experience it, but it's relatively common. What a physician will first try to do is to try to characterize this pain complaint to better understand it. This is with the eye of trying to figure out if there are any local-type therapies, such as radiation in the case of a metastatic bone lesion or a lesion to a nerve. And there are different characteristic pains, some of which have specific treatments, such as a neuropathic or nerve pain. But typically, most pain is treated with analgesics or pain relievers. These start out at our lowest rung of the analgesic ladder, which is basically Tylenol or nonsteroidal drugs such as Advil or Naprosyn. In some patients, these will suffice, and these are nice drugs because they have relatively few side effects. The next step of the analgesic ladder is to use combination drugs, which involve the drugs which I mentioned previously in combination with a weak opioid. And for many patients, this can be enough. But the problem with these drugs is because they're in combination with either Tylenol or the nonsteroidal drug, our total dose is limited by the toxicities of those drugs. with Tylenol, the total dose shouldn't exceed 4 grams a day or 2 grams in older patients. And all of the NSAID drugs, such as ibuprofen, have a maximum daily dose. So for patients who have continued pain despite the use of maximum doses of these combination medications, we change them to pure opioid medication. These can be drugs like morphine, oxycodone, fentanyl, or hydromorphone. And typically what is done is we allow the patient to use these medications in a as-needed fashion to try to get a sense for what their needs are. And once that need has been established, we kind of sum up the total dose. And if the characteristic of the pain is that it's a continuous pain, felt mostly throughout the day, we try to switch to, in part, to a long-acting medication that only has to be taken once, twice, or three times a day, or in the case of fentanyl patches, once every 3 days. Typically, we like to have about two-thirds of the total dose of the opioid medicine in this long-acting form because, ideally, the pain control regimen will be such that the patient does not have to be reminded by pain to take their medications. In addition to this continuous drug, breakthrough medication, which is basically short-acting versions of the same or similar medicines, are given when on an as-needed basis. But my general rule is if the breakthrough medication is being taken throughout the day, well, then the continuous dose of the medication has to be increased. In general, most medical oncologists are comfortable managing patients with cancer pain, but there are some patients that have pain which is refractory to these measures, and at that time, consultation with a pain specialist can be helpful. In general, what I say to patients is don't worry about dependence or addiction to opioid pain medications. Cancer pain is kind of a different story from the rest of pains that we encounter in medicine, and it has a really a special place. There's a special place for treatment with these drugs. The other is that if you're on a pain regimen, don't discontinue it immediately because sometimes that can precipitate unpleasant symptoms. Overall, we're quite effective in treating cancer pain, and I would say that over 80% of patients have their pain effectively managed. The next supportive care issue that I wanted to talk about really stems in part from treatment of pain. This is constipation. Constipation can actually be a very serious problem, and I find it's one of the limiting factors in our use of adequate pain medications. Relative inactivity of cancer patients can also contribute, but in general, the pain medications are the main offender here. Typically, we like to set up our patients with what's known as a bowel regimen, different types of medication which can help promote normal bowel movements. And there are multiple different types of medicines. They work on different principles. In general, I like to give patients two or three possibilities. People will generally have a preference to what they like, but oftentimes it takes a significant escalation of these medicines in order to achieve results. And it's important to work with your physicians and care providers in order to get this problem sorted out because it can become quite a serious problem. Fatigue is another problem that many cancer patients deal with. In general, fatigue can be a more challenging problem to address. The importance of exercise in patients that can do it is important, and for that I just recommend walking 20 minutes a day if that's possible, and that's been shown in clinical trials to improve how cancer patients feel and their symptoms. For people that are over-sedated from opioid pain medications, at times we'll prescribe a stimulant like Ritalin, another medication known as Provigil, or its generic name, modafinil, is helpful in some patients for promoting wakefulness. Weight loss is another common problem that we face. This, too, is a difficult problem to treat. In general, I like to explain to patients why this happens. There's two parts of the equation. One is decreased intake. Patients often have decreased appetite. Foods that used to be appealing are not appealing. And sometimes there are physiologic reasons why patients can't eat. What I liken it to is sometimes when you have a flu, the immune system creates chemicals which diminish the appetite. These same chemicals are produced by the immune system and perhaps by the cancer as well. All of these factors conspire to decrease intake. The other part of the equation is increased metabolism. The cancers in general are more metabolically active than normal tissues, and as such, they burn calories. The imbalance between intake and metabolism is what causes weight loss. Oftentimes, weight loss is a problem which is really more of a problem for patient's family and caregivers than the patient him or herself. And I oftentimes see conflict with patients and caregivers over food. And what I do through kind of the explanations that I had before is try to kind of normalize this as part of a cancer process, which is really difficult to fight for some patients. And what I do is I say any food that the patient likes to eat is good food. Sometimes we can do give appetite stimulants such as steroids, such and dexamethasone is one of those which we give. There's also a drug called Megase or Megesterol. These drugs have some mild impact on this problem. From a caregiver standpoint, I think the most important thing to do is to try to ensure that the patient has access to foods which they like. Another area of problems that affect some patients are respiratory symptoms, a generalized feeling of being short of breath or cough. In general, if a patient has a complaint of shortness of breath, we test oxygen levels, and if these oxygen levels are low, the patient's thought to benefit from supplemental oxygen. Sometimes even when the levels aren't particularly low, oxygen can be helpful. Other interventions which we can do is to give medications like the pain pills, which I talked about earlier, opioids. These blunt the sense of air hunger and help with the symptoms of shortness of breath. Another class of drugs called benzodiazepines, examples of which are lorazepam, also known as Ativan, can be helpful for lessening the anxiety that comes with breathlessness. Psychiatric issues are also very common in patients with cancer. Sleep disturbance is quite common, and in contrast to general practice where we try to encourage patients not to use sleeping medications, I find that sleeping medications can be very helpful to cancer patients. Anxiety and depression is a normal response to being faced with a diagnosis of cancer, and oftentimes patient symptoms, because it's a normal response, don't meet formal criteria for diagnosing anxiety or depression. This, however, does not mean that people will not benefit from medications designed to treat anxiety and depression. We have good medications for both of these problems, and in general, I highly encourage their use. Most oncologists are comfortable giving these, and they have relatively few side effects. In general, just like with the purpose of treatment in general, it's meant to enhance the quality of life, and these medications can go a long way in that regard. For some patients, meeting with a psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, or counselor can be very helpful. This is helpful for families as well and can help with the process of coping. So that ends my part talking about supportive care. I next wanted to talk about follow-up plans. First, in order to do that, I first have to talk about treatment. For most patients with cancer of unknown primary who are candidates for treatment with chemotherapy, chemotherapy is arranged into what we call cycles, which are typically last 3 to 4 weeks. And what's typically done is an assessment of disease with CT scan prior to starting, so we have a sense for where we're starting from. Chemotherapy is given. And after two or three cycles, we do another CT scan to see, in fact, how we've done. And in general, what we describe as success is that the cancer has not grown or, in fact, it has shrunk in response to treatment. In these cases, if the treatment is well tolerated, chemotherapy is continued for 4 to 6 total cycles. And in general, it stopped at that point because the chemotherapies have toxicities of their own, many of which are cumulative, and most therapies do not lend themselves to being continued indefinitely. After treatment with a given course of chemotherapy is ended, patients go on what's called a period of watchful waiting, or what I refer to as a chemotherapy holiday. Oftentimes, this gives patients time to recover from the toxicities of treatment and actually enjoy themselves without the rigors of treatment. During that time, I see my patients back, you know, usually on a monthly basis to assess their symptomatic needs. If there are further fit therapies down the line, which I think will be helpful, we do a scan about every 6 to 8 weeks to look for signs that the cancer, which had previously been treated with other chemotherapy, is growing to an extent to which that further treatment was needed. Or at least should be considered. And for patients that are doing better and it appears that their cancer is slow growing or has responded very well to chemotherapy, the frequency of visits is spaced out as I get a better feel for how the cancer is behaving. The last topic which I wanted to cover was communication. The relationship between oncologists and patients and their family is a very important relationship and one of the most intense in medicine. This is because the cancer itself is a very intense illness, and we also have are seeing patients on a frequent basis. It's important to have good communication. This creates better knowledge on both the patient side as well as on the physician side, and this results in better care. The topics discussed typically in an oncologist's office are complex and emotionally upsetting, and so this makes it hard to hear everything that's said. And for this reason and for many other reasons, it's an important idea to bring a family member or a friend or a caregiver to appointments, because oftentimes I hear patients and their families say when they go home, two people had totally different ideas of what was said, and I think it's important part of the communication to have more than one person listening to what's said. Another area in which it's communication I find can be helped is in management of medications. Oftentimes patients come to an oncologist with many medications, and then the oncologist adds quite a few more medications, and it's quite difficult to keep track of everything that's going on. I encourage patients to keep medication lists, understand the drugs they're taking, and if it's a complex amount of medications, that they should have a pharmacist involved if possible through the clinic and use what we call a MediSet, which is basically a box that helps organize medications. It's important to ask your physician how best to communicate with their office, know their numbers and who to contact. It's also important to feel comfortable doing this. I know I would much rather hear about a patient's problem earlier on before it becomes something serious. And I also want to stress the importance of feeling comfortable being a patient advocate or your own advocate for yourself, because it's really an important thing, and it's your right to receive good care. I'm going to end here. I hope I've stressed the importance of supportive care and communication for patients with cancer of unknown primary and cancer in general. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much, Dr. Eden, for just excellent, really excellent presentation, and really for really highlighting the importance of the doctor-patient communication component, and that indeed it is the patient's right to speak to their physicians, to bring someone with them, to have access to their doctor. That's really so important. And I know there'll be questions actually for you as well during the Q&A. Well, we now do have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Mary to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Joan.
I'd like to know what's being done in the way of clinical trials.
Well, thank you very much for that question, Mary. Dr. Greco, could you address that?
Yes. There are some. One is looking at molecular profiling in these patients and actually evaluating the patients, doing this molecular profile test, and then the prediction that the molecular profile makes. We're using that prediction to use a specific treatment for that individual patient. If the profile is unsuccessful or it predicts some form of malignancy where we don't feel like there's any standard therapy known, then we use an empiric regimen that's been developed in the past for those patients. So that should help us get a feel if, for instance, the patients with the profile for lung or the profile for colorectal or breast, et cetera, using site-directed therapy initially, perhaps will give them an advantage in outcome. That's one trial. There are others. There's one in Europe that's actually looking at these profiles and comparing site-directed therapy that the profile predicts versus just the empiric therapy. So patients would be randomly allocated to treatment the profile predicts versus empiric standard therapy that we've had for many years. And there are other trials as well, but I just list those two.
Dr. Echo, could you also speak a bit about the different phases of trial in terms of that, and that people understand the different the way trials are actually delivered and how they work?
Yeah. Well, phase one trials are where we're looking to fit a promising new substance or treatment. We're not even sure of the dose, and so we have to treat several patients. And any patient with cancer, advanced cancer, might be want to participate in a phase one trial. In phase two, we know the dose of the substance or the therapy that we're testing. We know which dose is safe, and we're trying to determine just how useful it is. And then in phase three, we're actually comparing new treatment to a standard form of therapy, patients receiving either the new treatment or the standard form. The CUP patients can fit into these categories to a certain degree, but it's difficult because CUP patients really aren't one type of cancer, and we've tried to emphasize that today.
Thank you very much. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Ruth.
Yeah, I was interested when Dr. Eden was talking about the different ways of supportive care, and that I was thinking that different foods are used for cutting pain and inflammation, and I would like to see if you could comment on that. And the second question I have is that very often the patient doesn't know how to look for trials, and unless the physician recommends a trial, the patient will never get into a trial. And I'm wondering that in different medical centers, if any of you have a system in which doctors are being trained to find trials, or that their library staff in these different centers or for doctors are doing any kind of training to get people more into trials. Thank you.
Ruth, thanks for those excellent questions. Thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. Eden to address the question about food in terms of whether there are, in terms of symptom or pain management. And I'm going to ask Dr. Varachari to talk about trial information to patients in their centers. Dr. Eden, would you go first?
Well, it's a bit of a it's a topic that of great interest to patients. Unfortunately, it's one that we don't know that amount much about, and that's the issue of foods and nutrition, nutritional supplements, and I would also say alternative medicines. in both treatment of cancer as well as treatment of cancer side effects. We do know that some foods and elements in foods do have anti-inflammatory properties in the lab, and also looking at large cohort studies where they study nutrition, they notice that people who eat certain foods are less likely to get cancer. The problem has been in terms of translating these epidemiologic findings, which is kind of observing how a large group of patients, not patients, but really subjects in a trial do, and translating that into something that we can use to treat patients. And a cautionary example, and there are actually many of these, is in the case of lung cancer. What was found from large trials, large epidemiologic studies, is that diets rich in beta-carotene were associated with lower rates of lung cancer. And so there were actually two large clinical trials looking at beta-carotene supplementation versus placebo in patients at risk for getting lung cancer by virtue of a history of smoking or asbestos exposure. And what was found is that the beta-carotene, which was thought to help prevent cancer, turned out to promote cancer. And I use this kind of as a cautionary example, meaning when there's all sorts of other data that would point to something being good, it really needs a clinical trial to confirm that. And Dr. Greco was talking about this as well. So with regarding foods, I can't really recommend any food or supplements. Again, my general advice is, to try to eat a general healthy diet. And if a patient is having a problem with weight loss, really eating anything that is appealing. And I'll stop there.
And actually, in terms of they're talking directly to their physician and the role of the dietitian at times, is that something that you, as part of the multidisciplinary team, is that something?
Yeah,
that you
and so to? Certainly in larger cancer centers, dietitians are an important part of our team, and they're usually more knowledgeable about dietary matters and can work with patients and their families, and I think many patients find this very helpful. It's not always available to all patients, but it can be a valuable part of it.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Bharachary, could you just address how do people get information about clinical trials or what are some interesting – we certainly refer people a lot to the National Cancer Institute for information.
I think the most important thing is communication between the patient's physician and the patient to decide if and when the patient is ready for a clinical trial. And some patients are very good candidates for upfront clinical trials with their new cancer diagnosis. Some patients may take some treatment and then may be ready for a more experimental phase one clinical trial. In terms of what's the best way of doing it? The physicians, if they belong to a comprehensive cancer center or a large network that has clinical trials, could definitely direct the patients. They may have the resources, the research nurses, the other staff that could help the patient make these decisions. Like you said, NCI is a good website. www.cancer.gov has information not only for healthcare professionals but for patients. To make some decisions about what clinical trials may be available in their area. Bottom line, I think if the patient discusses it with their physician, they are the best folks to help them make that call.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Vitus.
Hello. Hello. I'm a cancer patient. I used to have cancer of unknown primary. But as a result of PathWorks tissue of origin test, the results show that with about 23% sort of likelihood score, not likelihood, but similarity score, they diagnose it to be pancreatic in origin, even though there are no lesions in the pancreas, no visible lesions in the pancreas.
And your question, Vida?
The question is, how accurate is this test? Because the therapy is being changed as a result completely.
Let's see. Okay. Well, thank you for your question. And, of course, I'm going to ask Dr. Greco to address your question in a general way because we obviously want you back to your treating physician, but we hope the information you'll get from today will help you to be more informed as you discuss this with your physician. Dr. Greco, can you address this in a general way in terms of all of the assay tests, in terms of their
what we know about them,
and in terms of conceptually how they, what we understand how they best work?
There are several molecular assay tests. He mentioned just one. And these tests have been validated on known primary cancers, and it's fairly impressive. What I mean by known primary cancers is just that. We know where the cancer is coming from, for instance, the colon or the lung or the breast. And in that setting, when the patients have spread or metastasis, a biopsy of the metastasis is about 85 to 90% accurate in all the commercially available tests. So that's impressive. What we don't know for sure is how accurate they are in patients who have the cup tumors, because we don't know where the primary is from. So we just have to extrapolate. Well, if they're 90% accurate in known primary cancers, then they're perhaps 90% accurate in the cup cancers. The other thing we don't know for sure is, will they behave the same, even though they're called pancreatic, for instance? Will they behave the same when they're a cup cancer as pancreatic cancer behaves and perhaps responds to treatment the same as the pancreatic cancer? We don't know that yet. That's what clinical trials have to, we have to find out through clinical trials.
Excellent. Thank you. And any other comments about this? Because it's really an interesting question in terms of people's sense of their treatment and how helpful it can be for them. Dr. Bhattacharya or Dr. Eden?
In terms of seeing how the assay results fit into decision-making, like Dr. Greco said, the validation will likely stay indirect because it's unlikely that a primary tumor will be found. So what the physician would do typically is match the assay results to the patient's presentation. Did they have the risk factors, the pattern of spread of their cancer, any tumor markers, or anything to suggest that this is how the cancer is behaving? And it's a continuous process. It's looking at serial CAT scans, looking at the response. It's difficult to make it a one-time call as to yay or nay. So it's a difficult question, and I think as time goes on and as we all understand these assays better, we will be able to make better decisions and indirect validations as to how to interpret these results. It's just too early.
You know, the criteria for releasing a test is, you know, is different from a chemotherapy. And, you know, exactly how we use this test, there's no recommendation on how to use this test. It's really just a classifier, and it classifies a cancer with some certain probability as being a cancer like pancreas or lung or so forth. I just want to reiterate what the other doctors have said. It's not really clear to us exactly how information should be used. So treating the cancer as a pancreas cancer seems like a reasonable thing to do, but on the other hand, you could also, I would say, continue to treat it like cancer of unknown primary with the empiric regimens that we used to use, because in fact we don't know that the use of this test will necessarily improve the treatment.
We definitely, I think that we're talking about really being in a new area that is developing for everyone, both the healthcare professionals and the people living with CUP. So could we talk a bit about the complexity of working with them, the healthcare team, and really in terms of, I think, Dr. Bhattacharya, in terms of decision-making. It's obviously very hard for people living with CUP to make these decisions. And do you want to comment on just what can be very helpful to people in terms of really sitting down with their physician? I'd like all of you to comment on that because I think that each of you as practicing physicians have a good sense of that.
Yes, I like it has been touched on earlier, It is a very stressful diagnosis and anxiety-provoking diagnosis for the patients. They sometimes are concerned that perhaps enough tests have not been done to look for the primary cancer. Some patients tell me that, you know, doc, my family asks me what kind of cancer I have, and I have nothing to say. I don't know what to tell them. This is an unknown. I don't know what to write in my blog. I don't know, you know, who I can call for support. So these issues come up, and what is necessary is to educate our patients that it does exist as an entity. There are many other patients who have cancer of unknown primary, and even in that, we have subgroups of patients who have, even though it's a heterogeneous cancer, there are subgroups of patients who have similar presentations, and we are learning new technologies of how to manage these patients every day. So I think reassurance and a continuous, constant communication between the patient and doctor is essential to reassure the patient that everything is being done to treat the patient in a very tailored fashion, even though the primary cancer is not known.
Can I add just one other issue?
Yes, please.
I didn't mention that the molecular profiling There are several other studies looking at how accurate this is, and one way to do this is in patients who later develop their primary, who we discover it later. This is not common. In fact, it's very rare, but we've looked at a group of patients, up to 20 now, where we've actually found the primary cancers later on, ranging from 2 months out to nearly 5 years after they had the cup cancer, and we applied a molecular technology, a molecular assay, to the original biopsy. And in that group of patients, it was 75% accurate in predicting what the actual primary was. So we are developing more information about how useful this can be. That's not a definitive information, but it's very impressive, and we need more clinical trials, more data, in order to feel more comfortable that we can identify a patient's cancer by this new technology.
We know that you're continuing that research, and that's so important. Actually, thank you. And Dr. Eaton, did you want to comment as well?
Yeah, you know, the special issue that comes with cup cancers is, you know, this the word unknown in the diagnosis. And, you know, as Dr. Vattachary was saying, you know, from a doctor's standpoint, it is important to educate patients that although it has the word unknown in it, this is a known clinical entity. And the fact that its origin is unknown does not mean that we can't treat it. And, you know, I really tell patients it's very similar to, in terms of the way I think about the patients, very similar I would treat a lung cancer patient or something like that. Because, in fact, even for lung cancer patients where we can say this is your diagnosis, for a given treatment that I might propose, there's still uncertainty that I have as to whether or not it works or not. And uncertainty, unfortunately, is just part of the process. We oftentimes see patients in second opinion because of this uncertainty about diagnosis, and most of the time the overall plan is not significantly changed. I think if you feel that something is being missed or in some sort of lack of confidence in your treating physicians, a second opinion can be helpful because it may restore that confidence. And in general, the advice that I give to patients, and actually this is more advice that I give to patients who are physicians who tend to always want to second guess their doctors, is to find a physician that you trust, ask the right questions, keep them informed, but then, you know, try to have trust in that relationship and know that what they're doing is in your best interest.
Dr. Greco, when we had talked earlier, you had said that it's important also to see a physician, if you want to say something about that physician, in terms of asking them how many people with CUP that they're seeing in terms of getting a second opinion. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's always very reasonable to get a second opinion, rarely even a third opinion. And I agree and echo the statements just made by Dr. Eaton that you need to feel comfortable with the person you're seeing as a physician. There has to be some trust there, and education goes both ways. And this is such a complex area, the CUP cancer, that it takes more than the usual amount of time to go through this and talk about this. At the end of the day, most patients do feel a little better about it once they know a little more about it and once they see that there is some hope at the end of the tunnel here for treatments.
Thank you. I actually want to thank our speakers. They've really been outstanding, and I hope that you do feel that you've gotten some really helpful information and to help you as you think about your treatments and as you think about your treatment for COP, and that you actually feel you have some new ideas here. I want to thank all of our speakers. I want to also thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions. We know that you ask the questions to get help for yourself, but in asking your questions, you end up helping everybody on the call, and you help us to elaborate on points and think about other things that we can discuss. So I want to thank all of you and those of you who have been listening as well. Now, I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour telephone education workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of our program. So that I do want to, again, remind all of you that although this program will be soon concluding, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those continue, and those are free services, and I want to go over them with you. Cancer Care has a staff of 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling, to someone to talk to when you are feeling stressed or don't quite know what to do or concerned about making decisions, that we're a staff that you can talk to about some of your concerns. So that, and we do talk to people individually, and we also do speak to people in groups. We do run support groups here, both on the telephone and online. In addition to that, we also offer groups for people living with cancer as well as people who are caregivers. So we have groups for really for everybody. And we also talk to people individually as well. We also have a number of telephone workshops that are coming up. You have a calendar of that in your materials. And we have a number of publications that you might find helpful, publications about coping with cancer, about some of the stresses of cancer, dealing with side effects and pain management. So those are things that you can access from us as well. And also, we are available to you. Our toll-free number is 1-800-813-HOPE. And our website is www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in dealing with cancer. I want you to now feel you're part of a community of support and that you can access free services from Cancer Care and all the other organizations that are listed as resources for you as well. So please do call us with any questions you didn't get to ask and or if you need any support or help in just coping with cancer. I want to thank you for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.